Hey everyone, and welcome back to Scorncast, the official podcast of the Pop Scorn movie blog, which can be found at scornpop.blogspot.com. This is Jasper. In Harry Potter vernacular, I'm known as the boy who napped. And joining me today, as usual, is Ghostface Milla, my co-host, friend, and winner of the as-yet-unaired Season 3 of Paris Hilton's My New BFF. On this episode, we'll be discussing the much-anticipated Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2, in which... Wait, do you really need a synopsis?
He knows. You know who. He knows we broke into Gringotts. He knows what we took, and he knows we're hunting Horcruxes.
How is it you know?
I saw him.
You let him in. Harry, you can't do that.
Hermione, I can't always help it. Well, maybe I can, I don't know.
Never mind what happened.
Well, he's angry and scared too. He knows if we find and destroy all the Horcruxes, we'll be able to kill him. I reckon he'll stop at nothing to make sure we don't find the rest. Oh, there's more. One of them's at Hogwarts.
What? You saw it?
I saw the castle and Rowena Ravenclaw. It must have something to do with her. We have to go there now.
What? We can't do that. We've got to plan. We've got to figure it out.
Hermione, when have any of our plans ever actually worked? We plan, we get there, all hell breaks loose.
So, Ghostface, are you so sad right now?
I am. I am really sad. I can't even tell you, like, how quiet and somber we all were when we left the theater.
Well, before we get into a specific discussion of Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2, I kind of want to talk about the series a little bit, because I definitely feel like our final judgments of this movie might be better communicated if we explain where we're coming from. And where we're coming from is, we're looking at this movie from two different points of view, I guess. I'm definitely someone who likes this series in general, but I haven't read all the books, and I haven't necessarily been in love with all the movies. In fact, I think some of the movies are a little problematic, but we'll get into that in a few minutes. So,
yeah.
Ghostface, would it be fair to call you a Harry Potter superfan?
yeah, I mean, I, unlike you, I read all the books several times.
Burn.
No, that's not a dig. I mean, it just, but I'm better than you.
Yeah. I'll give you that.
No, I mean, I'm super into it. You know, there's times when I forget characters' names or, like, the order of events, but I definitely go into these films knowing what's going to happen, and I do, like, judge them as far as, like, how much they change. But, yeah, I mean, I'm definitely more of a fan than you, that's for sure.
Snob. So, as Popscorn's resident snob, I mean, Harry Potter super fan, give me your overall thoughts on this series in general. Like, what are some personal high points and low points for you?
So, definitely the high point for me is the Alfonso Cuarón directed The Prisoner of Azkaban, which was the third one, which is still, I think, probably my favorite book in the series. But I think he was really, really key to this whole series. He took it from being this Chris Columbus, family-friendly, holiday time, magic and wonderment, festivity, kids' fair, and he really made it into, you know, what it deserved to be, which is, you know, this tale that is more than just magic and wizards and whatever. There's a mythology here that's really rich, and there's this whole kind of, like, genocidal, you know, kind of context or subtext throughout that is really deep and kind of dark for a lot of, like, kids to even grasp. The parents obviously get it, whatever. And, you know, and there's also, there's a humor in these books, and you know, it comes up in the movies later, that balances really well with kind of the darker moments or the scarier moments, you know, in a kind of British sort of way. And I think Alfonso Cuarón, so that he, you know, without him, I don't think the movies would have gotten to the point where they did. I think my low point is the one that immediately followed that, which was directed by Mike Newell, and it was The Goblet of Fire. And that one was just, it was like a parody. It was just, like, so sad, and the characters are so, like, overdramatic, and, like, even Dumbledore, Michael Chabon, he was, like, really over the top in that movie. But, you know, like, that movie, it didn't deal well with the humor and the, you know, and also the seriousness at the same time, and, you know, they kind of, like, dumbed down the story so much that it didn't even really feel like a Harry Potter film. It was just kind of this, like, weird, it almost felt like one of those, like, Narnia movies, that there was, like, all this fantastic stuff going on, but, like, you weren't really connected to any of it. And I think you felt the same about some of them, too, like, the later ones, like, they were probably really good for fans, but not so good for just, you know, avid filmgoers.
Yeah, I agree with you. Prisoner of Azkaban is a definite highlight of the series. And I do think a lot of that credit goes to Alfonso Cuarón, who I just think he's just an exquisite storyteller. And that film might be the only one in the series where I got like a perfectly clear sense of what it would be like to live in this fantasy world.
Yeah.
For me, it's just like complete pure delight. And I can get lost in the details of it time and time again. And I get hung up on this one ridiculous moment. But there's a scene where Harry is, I think, taking his first ride on the Hippogriff. And there's a shot where the Hippogriff swoops down close to a lake or a river or some body of water, and it dips its hoof in, and it just kind of glides. And there's that shot of the hoof causing all these ripples in the water. And it always gives me chills for some nerdy reason that I can't explain. I think that's where the series really proved its worth for me, not just in that moment, but in the bigger sense. You didn't get any beats like that in Chris Columbus's adaptations of the first two.
Right. No, not at all. I think those ones were so, like, you know, they felt like Hook to me, and that, like, the magic was, like, the centerpiece. It wasn't, like, a means to the end. It, like, was the end. But every, like, charm and spell that they did had, like, 20 minutes of its own in the movie, and, like, that's not how they're paced. You know, in the books, like, it's all very quick. Sometimes they mention some of the funniest and, like, you know, zaniest spells just, like, in a sentence, and it's over. And Alfonso Cuarón really understood that, and so there's things going on in the background, and it's all very happening, you know, it's kind of fast and whatever, but like you said, you know, you can get lost in the details of it. He also added a lot to it, this whole, all the symbolism of time and everything. He moved to the castle location so that they'd have, like, more kind of stuff to work with that was actually closer to how it is in the book. I think overall he just made it more British, which is what it needed, and I think American audiences, they weren't lost. They followed right along. You know, everything kind of made sense. I think David Yates did a great job. Order of the Phoenix was not my favorite, but I think he definitely picked up the pace and, you know, made up what is kind of an extremely long book that has a lot of things going on. You know, he kind of made it as coherent as he could as far as, like, you know, sort of cinematic in the way that there's, you know, a plot with a beginning and an end, but also carrying on this franchise and making things get, you know, bigger and bigger every time.
I definitely think that the first two movies almost feel like what you were saying about Hook. That's actually really funny. I feel like they're sort of like magic by test committee or test audience or test screening, like those panel things that they get where people like comment. Like they just feel very much that. And the first one is so static, it's almost stifling. And if I remember correctly, I think it took Chris Columbus until the second movie to really do cinematic things and to actually move his camera around the exterior of Hogwarts. And I think we touched on the special effects of this series when we did our Oscar Scorncast, but you look at Sorcerer's Stone, and some of those special effects are just really terrible. I'm thinking of the troll and the centaur.
Yeah, horrible. And the Harry on top of them.
The CGI Harry? Like, yeah. Not good.
It's like this, like, weird ragdoll.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it was only 10 years ago, which is shocking.
Right.
You look at Jurassic Park, which is, what, almost 20 years ago, and I don't understand why. I mean, you know, I just don't get it. I think the special effects were improved in Chamber of Secrets, but again, I think Prisoner of Azkaban is where they really stepped up their game as far as that was concerned also. I guess I feel the need to just say that I've read the first four books, and I read them in the space of, I think, maybe 2 weeks. They were all that was out at the time. Like, Order of the Phoenix had not been published yet. So I digested all those very quickly, and then a couple years later when Order of the Phoenix came out, I got it, and I bought all the Harry Potter books, but like most things I buy, I just never get around to reading them or watching them. But I've not read the last three, so my opinions of the series might be affected by that. I'm not, you know, terribly familiar with the source material. I've read sort of like overviews, like plot summaries of the series, but I've not, you know, delved into like the subtleties of J.K. Rowling's writings and that kind of stuff. But I would say for me, the low points of this series were, I didn't really mind Goblet of Fire so much. I feel like we disagree so little on here that I might be on the verge of tears right now that we actually disagree. I remember really liking the book, and I remember liking the Triwizard Tournament, and seeing that, I guess, realized on the screen was a lot of fun for me. But I would say that when David Yates took the series over, I started to have issues with it, and I don't think that they necessarily stem from David Yates, because I think that he is a good director, and he's, you know, tasked with probably the three most difficult books in the series, as far as the maturing of the characters goes, especially. And the tone, of course, how the tone gets more serious as the story closes. But I would say that I don't know if this stems from me not being that familiar with the source material, but I have problems with the storytelling in those last three movies. And the most recent one, The Deathly Hallows Part 1, it just kind of lost me completely. And I tried to rewatch it before I saw Part 2, the same evening, actually. And I remember getting through, like, the first 45 minutes or so and thinking, you know, this is not so bad. I think you might have been a little too hard on it the first time you saw it. And then immediately thereafter, I was like... So, it's all the camping, really.
Right. Yeah. You don't care for camping.
I don't, not unless Oscar Wilde is involved. Hey!
Right. I know what you're going to say, or I totally understand what you're saying, and I think David Yates actually did a pretty good job in bringing some of the less cinematic elements of this franchise to life, you know, in actually, like, a pretty... I mean, for me, like, I found the movies pretty entertaining and pretty compelling. Knowing the source material and seeing, you know, the worst it can be, I guess, with Columbus and Newell, and then kind of, like, seeing it bounce back, you know, so it kind of recovered, I think, itself. I was surprised at how much I liked Half-Blood Prince the first time I watched it, because that book, like, even reading that book, I was like, how the hell are they going to do this? I was like, it's all flashbacks, it's all talking, people standing around and talking, you know, it was like the educational parts of the Da Vinci Code. It was kind of like, how are they going to explain this? You know, and they didn't have Ian McKellen, like, they didn't have this narrating type character or whatever. But I was just kind of like, this is going to be really weird. And, you know, obviously they figured a way to do it with the pensive or whatever, and, you know, people go inside the memories and all that stuff. But I still think that, like, it wasn't just, like, a series of flashbacks. Like, they still kind of, like, built the stuff, and at the end it got, like, super crazy with that whole scene. It's really scary. and then they kind of take a turn, and part one of Deathly Hallows, it's, like, this weird, rambling kind of road trip movie that's, like, actually rather slow. And there's kind of an underlying current of suspense, but it's not really suspenseful. It's kind of just, like, you're almost waiting for something to happen. And I gotta tell you, that's kind of how the book is. Like, I think they did a really good job. I think, you know, I didn't love the first half of that book, so it's kind of like, oh my god, get to it already. But, like, I tried to reread it before the new movie came out, and I was like, oh right, I didn't like the beginning of this book, but, like, I liked that movie. I think it was just really seeing these actors, these characters, like, kind of grow up and, you know, all that stuff, and then, like, see the uncomfortable scenes where they kind of hate each other because they're wearing this, like, evil necklace locket thing that has, like, you know, a part of Voldemort's soul. Like, I think it was just, like, seeing all that stuff come to life. Like, I couldn't not like it.
I've enjoyed watching these kids grow up, too. Is that creepy? I like watching kids grow up. But it is weird. It is weird, like, seeing Daniel Radcliffe, like, as a kid in the first one. He was, like, 9 years old, and now he's, like, he's taking his clothes off, and you see body hair, and I feel kind of weird about the whole thing. Like, I should cover my eyes, right?
Yeah, and the whole audience is like, hey, girl! at least my audience was.
Well, New York, right?
Be honest, I'm the one who said it. Everybody laughed.
Of course, I should have known. But yeah, let's go ahead and seg right into Deathly Hallows Part 2. I feel like I should let you take the reins here since you're the super fan.
I really, really liked it. Like, there was, it reminded me a lot of Dark Knight. And I know that sounds crazy, but there was a tension throughout this whole movie that was very real. You know, it was very intense, and it was also very grand. You know, like, it really did feel like it was the be-all, end-all, you know, shit got real, and people died, and they dealt with everything, I think, pretty well, you know, like, I don't know a fan that didn't like it, and, you know, I've talked to some people that aren't super fans that were like, oh, I thought it was pretty good, but every, like, you know, diehard fan that I talked to was like, I loved it, I can't wait to see it again. And there's also some funny moments, like, some that were purposeful and some that weren't. We can talk about the epilogue later, but I think it was kind of awesome. It was kind of everything I ever wanted it to be and more.
I remember when we were talking off mic and you told me that I was not allowed to turn this into a Scorncast. So I'm going to wait and say all my bad things until after the sleeping pills that I slipped you take effect, so you can't argue with me. But I was actually surprised by how gripped I was by this movie, considering the last couple movies I have not really been gigantic fans of. And I definitely think that, you know, this movie is pretty much all climax. It's 2 hours and 10 minutes long, and it's sort of like the exact opposite of Deathly Hallows Part 1. It's free of that really mopey tone and all that exposition and all the, you know, the glowering in that movie and them being in the woods. I know it's been said probably by a lot of other people, but there were definitely times in the first movie when I felt like I was watching, like, just a higher quality Twilight movie. Like, if Twilight had been given, like, a better director and more interesting characters, this is kind of what that would be. But this movie is just completely all climax, and it's shocking how exciting it is to see two wizards shoot plasma bolts at each other, or whatever you want to call them.
Colorful in a way that it's, like, really entertaining and not, like, cheesy. It's not like a Joel Schumacher movie.
But Harry Potter does not have nipples on his Hogwarts robe.
right, yet. Yeah, there were so many scenes where people were just, like, looking up, you know, like, in a way that reminds me of, like, the Return of the King, like, before that big old battle scene, you know, where everyone is kind of, like, looking to the sky and, like, looking, like, worrisome and looking determined and looking kind of scared and, like, you know, and, like, it got kind of, like, ridiculous. People are just standing around looking up. But at the same time, it made it seem more grand, you know, it made it seem more, like, real. And everyone's kind of running around and scrambling, and then they're all kind of stopping and being like, oh, my God, this is really it, you know. But, yeah, I loved that, and I love the whole Snape flashback, you know, that whole, like the redemption of Snape, you know, like, it was, like, so great, and I sobbed my fucking eyes out. I really did, and, like, that's the other thing, too, I have to say about this whole series, is that they did a really good job at casting. You know, I mean, there's definitely some people that were underused, but I think are really good actors and actresses, but I think as far as all the main people, they did a really, really good job. Alan Rickman is brilliant as Snape. He is so brilliant, and he plays all the levels of him so well. And, you know, even when you think that he's evil, but you know that he's good, and you see the original, you know, movies, like, you can tell that all that stuff is under there, and all that background and history, and, you know, that's not an easy thing to do. And, you know, I really did hate him for so many of the movies, but when he died, I sobbed.
Yeah, you weren't the only one. We talked about what happened in my theater. I'm not going to bore people with it, but you were probably on the low end of sobbing compared to some of the stuff that I've heard. Yeah, he's an actor who savors every single word that he says. Like, he takes his time getting each line out. And it's absolutely delicious. Like, I can't even think of a better adjective to describe the way he approaches this character.
So, it makes me want to come up with, like, James Lipton adjective.
Scrumtralescent.
Yeah, he really is. Like, he's scrumtralescent. And, like, it just sends, like, shivers down my spine. You know, like, his delivery on everything is so good.
Yeah, he can turn, like, monosyllabic words into, like, 15-second...
20 syllables are so creepy.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
And someone else who I thought really got her moment, her way overdue moment to shine in this movie was Maggie Smith.
Oh, yeah.
Who's always sort of been lurking around in the background in the other movies and providing, you know, she's one of those screen legends, and has that presence that's so warm and wonderful, but she has this line in this movie where she sees Harry for the first time in a while, I guess, and it's so good to see you, but the way she delivers the line might be worth the price of admission.
Right, totally, yeah, because you get everything. You get everything from that character and what she means and what's been going on, you know, contextually in their world. So she's brilliant. I'm so glad that she was able to do this. You know, there's, like, talks of her, like, health declining or whatever, and I was like, I swear to fucking God, if they recast Minerva McGonagall in, like, the last movie, you know, or if they just, like, cut that part out, you know, God forbid, like, they just, like, don't deal with that part. But no, everything worked out. She's amazing in it. And she has, you know, she steals, like, a scene or two, you know, just from being who she is.
Even Matthew Lewis as Neville Longbottom, I thought, was you know, sort of a scene stealer in this movie, too.
Yeah, absolutely. There's several scenes. And I loved that they did that, too. Like, that was totally true of the book. And actually, I think it happened even earlier, but he really asserts himself in this one. And I'm glad that they gave him that moment because, you know, a lot of people would have been upset. He, you know, if you don't know the mythology, in a sense, he could have been the the Boy Who Lived, he could have been Harry Potter. It just kind of depended on whose house Voldemort went to first, because they were both born on the same day. So it's really important that, like, Neville has that moment, you know, because he, in a sense, is Harry's equal. He could have been Harry's equal.
And one of the things that I really, really delighted in about this movie is Helena Bonham Carter, who just, I find her to be such an underused comedian in movies. You know, she's somebody that people look on because of her, you know, sort of strange appearance, what she wears to awards shows. But she's so funny, and I was so happy that in this series in which she's played a complete, you know, freak who's terrible and distressing to look at for so many movies now, she actually got a moment to sort of be funny, which is there's a scene early on in the film where they're trying to break into her character's vault at Gringotts, and Hermione has to take Polyjuice Potion in order to transform herself physically into Helena Bonham Carter's character, who's Bellatrix Lestrange. And even though it's essentially, like, supposed to be Hermione as Bellatrix, and Emma Watson is providing the dialogue, and Helena Bonham Carter is just moving her mouth to it, still, it's, like, so funny to see her in that getup, in that hair, in that makeup, in those clothes, like, sort of be funny, because the scene is sort of played for laughs, such that, you know, she's trying to impersonate this horrible person who almost killed her in the last movie.
Yeah, I love that part, too, and, like, her walking, and, like, her little nervous looks, and all that stuff. It was, like, really well done.
The sleeping pills have not taken effect yet, I can see, but I do have three points that I would like to make about this movie, and I guess about some of them are about the series in general. Just coming from a perspective of, like, the non-superfan, I would say that there are things in this movie that I didn't quite get, and maybe they make more sense on the page. And I guess one definitive example of that I can point out is that dealing with these Horcruxes, there's a scene where all the characters are at Hogwarts, or the students are, and they're talking about the Horcruxes and how to find them and destroy them. And they're looking for a diadem that's hidden somewhere in the castle. And one of the characters, Cho Chang, says, there's not a person alive who's seen it. And in a subsequent scene, Luna Lovegood decodes that as meaning that it's in the Room of Hidden Things. And it's just one of those story points where I'm like, well, is the fact that there's not a person alive who's seen it, is that like some sort of code that you're supposed to gather that from? Or was that just something that Cho Chang said because she knows that nobody's seen it? And if so, how did Luna decode that? Like, I just, it's one of those like weird story points that might make more sense if you've read the books, right?
I barely remember that from the book, that whole part. Like, I remember Harry finding it, and it was kind of like, whatever. But yeah, I mean, that was kind of a weird thing. I guess he must have talked to the ghost in the book. I just totally, like, just forgot that whole section. Because that was one of the things, too, that was kind of frustrating about the book, is that, like, they spent so much of it, like, looking after, like, this one Horcrux or whatever, and then they find, like, four in, like, 30 seconds. You know, like, they find, like, all of them, like, so soon after each other.
Yeah, isn't part one just sort of centered around one Horcrux? And then
it's like one or two, and then it's like, bam, all of them at once in the second part, yeah.
There's a point in the first part where somebody says, you know, well, we destroyed this locket, there's only, like, four more to go, and I just remember in the theater watching that going, oh my god, seriously?
It's gonna go on for seven more hours?
Yeah, but they go through it very quickly. I mean, the pace of this thing is very, very tight.
I think they had to break it. I mean, just as far as, like, the acts go, you know, like, so if you think of the first movie as kind of the first act, like, they make the first one or two seem really, really difficult. And then, you know, they kind of get a little bit better at it, and they realize that time's a ticking kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. And I think that this is, from talking to people who've read the books, from other super fans, that this is something that happens actually in the books. But I just feel like this series has kind of a strange relationship with death, particularly in killing off its major supporting characters. Having not read Order of the Phoenix before I saw the movie, I remember that I knew that Sirius Black died in that book, but then when it finally came time for him to die in the movie, and he sort of got pushed backwards through that mirror, or whatever it was, I remember thinking, like, wait, what? Like, it just seemed to me like they were setting it up so that he could potentially, like, come back. Like, I want my wizards when they die to be, like, you know, a pile of ashes on top of, like, a pair of shoes.
Yeah, and I think a lot of their deaths have been kind of anticlimactic, in a sense, like, and I think that might just be the way it is in the wizard world or something. I don't know. You know, Cedric Diggory's death is kind of very, like, he just plops on the ground. all very sad, you know, and whatever. Harry was there, and it, you know, it happened to him, or while he was there, it happened to his parents, you know, blah, blah, blah. But it really is just like a spell, quick, it's done. And Sirius Black wasn't even like that. Like, I don't even think, he wasn't even hit with, like, the killing curse. He just, like, went through this weird kind of Stonehenge gateway that was, like, you know, the doorway to the other side kind of thing. It was almost like the gate to the afterlife. And he couldn't come back. Like, it's just, so there's all these, like, weird rules that, you know, are written in later kind of thing or thought up later of, like, oh, well, that person can exist in a portrait, but they can't do anything. They can't say anything. You know, Dumbledore, after he passes, is always just in his on his portrait, and he's asleep. You know, he's just there, and he's asleep. And it's like, well, why won't he wake up? Like, why can't we talk to him? We can talk to other portraits of dead people. You know, and so there's all these, like, crazy rules that, like, kind of don't make any sense, but they're just, like, you know, it's, like, just to push the story along. And I think even the way Voldemort dies is kind of anticlimactic. Like, they made it more cinematic in the movie in that he, like, kind of breaks apart into all these ashes. In the books, the spell that Harry uses is basically a spell that knocks your wand out of your hand. Expelliarmus charm, or spell, or whatever. And that's, like, what kills Voldemort. Which, like, you know, I remember reading that and being like, really? Like, that's it? There's a lot of the deaths that, you know, they either don't see them at all, and you just hear about them, which I think in some ways can be better, or they just happen and you're like, that's it.
Yeah, I remember, like, in the first part of Deathly Hallows when Mad-Eye Moody died, or when, well, I don't remember him dying because they actually never show it, but when they get back, when all the characters reconvene at the Burrow, one of them is like, yeah, Mad-Eye Moody's dead. And I was like, yeah, he's not going to stay dead, because they killed him off screen. And one of my friends, who is a Harry Potter super fan, was like, no, he's dead. So,
yeah, it's like those kind of things. I remember forgetting that from the book and being like, oh, wait, is he really? No, he is. Oh, right. Okay, whatever. You know, like, it's kind of that thing that just happens really quickly.
And especially, there's a sequence in this movie where Harry's, you know, taking care of business in very important ways, but then he sort of walks back through the castle and you see, you know, a couple major characters dead on the floor. And I understand that it's sort of, like, interesting to see that while he was taking care of all the things he had to take care of, there was still, you know, a really big fight going on, and it was a fight that cost a lot of people their lives. So in that respect, it, you know, it makes sense. But at the same time, I feel like these are things that may have happened in the books, but this is, you know, a cinematic adaptation of these books, and it might have been a little bit better if you'd actually seen these moments happen.
The books are kind of from Harry's perspective, so you don't often see things or experience things that mm-hmm. Harry himself is not seeing.
Yeah.
And she kind of had to break that narrative structure, I want to say in the sixth one, mostly because of the flashbacks and all of that stuff, but she might have broken it earlier and I just, you know, have a bad memory. But they were forced to do that with the films. You know, they had to show things that were just Voldemort and his kind of clan. You know, sometimes things like Harry was experiencing it with Voldemort, and so he could sense it, and, you know, he knew, and they kind of went back and forth in between that. And sometimes it was just like, Harry's not around at all, and this is happening without him, and he doesn't even know, you know, to create the drama. It's definitely more entertaining to see the things like that, and I think it's more of what we're used to, parallel editing and stuff like that. Seeing some of the deaths, like, I'm not going to lie, like, I think it's George is the twin that passes away, that's killed. I cried when I saw him there, and I cried when Ron was crying. Seeing him there, I don't know if I could have taken actually watching him die. Like, the Snape death was bad enough, you know?
Yeah, I'm thinking about some of the people that were in my screening, and I'm actually thinking maybe it was good that they didn't show the deaths on screen.
But, you know, they do show them there lying, you know, cold and lifeless, and Harry sees them and he's sad. And all that stuff happens very quickly, just as it did in the movie, but it's still, like, super, super sad. And I was like, you know what, like, those are characters that, like, are barely in these movies, and they're in the movie, they're in the books a little bit more, but still not that much. They just have a little bit more personality, and I kind of don't want to see them die. Like, I'm almost okay with them dying, but I don't want to see it, you know? Like,
yeah.
Cause there's some other deaths, like Hedwig dies in the first part, and it happens so quickly, and it's this, you know, this owl, this like link to the magical world when he wasn't at school. It happens so fast that you almost don't get any catharsis out of it. It's just like, oh, that happened.
And speaking of things that happen very quickly, I would say one of the big set pieces I knew that was coming in this film just from hearing my friends talk about it and how they couldn't wait for this scene to be on film was the scene where Molly Weasley finally faces down and kills Bellatrix Lestrange. There's no build-up to it. It cuts from something else happening somewhere else in the castle to, like, Jenny Weasley being hit from, like, some sort of, like, spell that Bellatrix has cast, And then Molly just kind of steps in, and they go at it for a few seconds, and then, you know, she hits Bellatrix, and Bellatrix sort of evaporates, or explodes. But the way that it's done, I just found really odd. Like, you just see Jenny Weasley getting hit, and then you see Bellatrix standing there, and Molly jumps in and says, you know, that famous line that got the whole crowd on their feet. But that, I mean, that scene is just so abrupt. I'm sort of mystified by that one.
Yeah, it was almost like they didn't want to put it in, but they realized they had to, or something. You know, and that's one of those things that when I read it, I was like, oh, that's gonna be such a big deal in the theater. Like, that's such, like, a, you know, like, there's snakes on these motherfucking planes. I can't even say the line right. you know, the Samuel Jackson line. Like, it's one of those things that, like, people, like, would quote, like, in message boards and stuff. They'd say, like, you know, not my daughter, you bitch, or whatever the hell she says. And, you know, it's this thing that's like, oh, wow, Mrs. Weasley is, like, really the one to watch, you know. She's crazy. I think she was trending on Twitter, like, the whole next day, because that's, like, such a mean-feeling moment. I found it very underwhelming.
Yeah.
I was, like, expecting so much more. And I also don't remember it being, like, well, it was so strange because, and I think they just staged it awkwardly, you know, she goes after her, you know, she says that line, not my daughter, you bitch, or whatever, and then she goes after her, but then she has this look of fear on her face, like Bellatrix might kill her, and she, like, gets, you know, hit back, like, 3 or 4 times, and she's kind of like, oh, crap, what did I do? And then she's like, wait a minute, no. And then she goes after Bellatrix and kills her, and it was kind of like, it could have gone any way at that point, and in the book, it was very clear, like, she's that line, and then she kills her. You know, like, it happened pretty quickly. They went back and forth, maybe, but not in a way that was, like, so, like, one-sided. So I was kind of like, all right. Like, I'm so happy that it happened and that they showed it, but I was also like, they could have done that maybe a little cleaner.
I don't want to make my final point be negative, but I guess it's more of an open question. But now that all the cards are on the table, I feel like Voldemort is not a particularly memorable villain. I mean, we've gotten a few flashbacks to his childhood over the course of the series, but nothing I would call terribly compelling, and little that really fills in for me those years between him being this, you know, dangerous student with a dark side at Hogwarts and becoming the most fearful evil wizard of all time. And I love Ralph Fiennes, and I like the flavor that he brings to Voldemort's dialogue. He sounds like he's this almost, like, weary aristocrat snob. Like, if he didn't have slits for nostrils, he'd probably be hanging out at some posh country club telling all these, like, self-enamored personal anecdotes to a cluster of admirers. But
right. When
I think of this series, the bad guys for me who really pop out in my head are ones like Bellatrix Lestrange and Dolores Umbridge, probably mostly due to the performances of Imelda Staunton and Helena Bonham Carter. Even the Dementors really stand out in my mind. But Voldemort, I mean, how do you feel as someone who's read the books? Because I'm just going on the movies I've seen.
Yeah, I mean, I could say kind of the same thing about the book series in that, you know, his reputation is worse than he actually comes off, you know? And it's part of it that it is kind of for kids and that, you know, he can't do anything that's super, super bad. But he still does, like, torture people and crazy shit happens and whatever else. And he is scary, but there was something about, you know, kind of like the fight scenes and stuff like that, like with Voldemort, that I was still kind of like, I feel like he's holding back. Like, why wouldn't he just kill him, you know? And there was, I think, one point where this was stuff that, like, was not in the book at all. You know, he's using his robe, his, like, ever-growing black robe to hoist Harry up and strangle him, you know? And I was just kind of like, that's cool. It looks really cool. I don't know that he would have done that in the middle of a fight. Like, if anything, he would have strung Harry up like that, like, in the forest or something and made everyone laugh at how powerless he was. I don't know. I think they had some aspects of the character right. And, you know, I did think Ralph Fiennes' performance was pretty good. I think, for me, like, Voldemort was really never the reason I read the books. And he was never really, like, what I was afraid of. As far as, like, oh my god, Voldemort has this final piece and, you know, he can rule the world. It was kind of never like that. It was kind of like, what if all the evil is successful, you know? Like, that, like, even the battle scene in the book, it you know, there's more of a build-up of, like, he's got the ogres on his side, and he's got the spiders on his side, and he's got all these witches, you know, and they showed all that stuff in the movie, but in the book it was more of, like, Voldemort's support system, you know, the Dementors, like, all the stuff that you're talking about. And so I think you're right. In a sense, it's true to the books, because as far as how I felt, You know, I was never that really into Voldemort or thought he was that scary. Especially, you know, when it boils down to it, you know, it's like Voldemort is not powerful because he's never loved. And it's kind of like, okay, like, you know, yeah. The kid's book. what do you do?
Do you want to have one final word about that epilogue?
Yeah, I mean, so many words.
Or several final words.
Yeah, the several things come to mind, especially Ginny Weasley's soccer mom haircut.
Oh my God!
Actually, that was probably the best teaching technique that they used. You know, I read the actor's praise for that scene as they were filming it. They were, like, all talking about it in interviews, and they were like, oh, it's really well done. We used prosthetics, and it turned out really nice, and da-da-da, and I was so skeptical. And I watched the movie, and, you know, it's cute. It's so schmaltzy, and it's so, like, just this, you know, pleasantries kind of all about whatever.
Maybe it's earned schmaltz, though.
It's definitely earned schmaltz. Oh, yeah, yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, I'm not discounting it for that. But it, even in the book, it feels like that. So yeah. I think they really hit the tone of it right. But there is a line missing, and it's a pretty important line because it kind of, like, definitively says that Voldemort is gone. And it's something like, you know, his son, Albus Severus Potter, says something like, you know, Dad, does your head still hurt, you know, every once in a while or whatever? And he says something like, no, it hasn't in 19 years, you know, and it never will again or whatever. And it's basically just definitively saying, like, Voldemort is gone and everything is fine, you know, and that this book series does not need to continue just because we all have kids. And, you know, and in a sense, like, the movie kind of did that too, but really it was just kind of ridiculous to see them. You know, Ron has a belly and Hermione doesn't really look any older. She just has a slightly bigger nose. You know, Harry looks sort of older, but, like, not really. I mean, it's, you know, it's kind of absurd. And, like, his son has, like, a Justin Bieber haircut, you know, for some reason. I don't know.
I will say that when Ginny Weasley, or Ginny Weasley Potter, I guess? Is she a hyphenator?
Right. She's probably a hyphenator. Yeah, totally.
When she walked out, all I could think of was, like, who stole Marcia Gay Harden's hair and put it on top of her body?
Yeah. I'm sad that, like, she, like, didn't really have, like, a line or anything, because yeah. I've always loved Ginny, and I, you know, I wanted to love older Ginny.
And instead, you just loved her hair.
Right. Instead, I just loved her hair, and I think they gave her hips. Too, which was nice.
I think that they must have moved to Texas for a while, right?
Yeah, totally.
Burn on Texas. Do you want to do the grades? What grade would you give Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2? I almost feel stupid asking you this question, but let's go ahead and answer it.
I'd give it an A.
Wow.
Yeah, I really, really liked it. I thought it was really well done.
I feel generous tonight. I think I went in thinking it was a B+, but in all honesty, there is a whole lot to like about this movie. I you know, made a few nitpicks, but overall, I think it's a really fitting conclusion to what is probably a pretty terrific series all in all. So I'll go A-. When they do another one, which, you know, they will, like, some movie producer will be like, no, we should just, you know, there's no books anymore, but we should go ahead and make a ninth movie. Will you allow me to, like, scorn that one?
Yeah, I will be the first one in line to scorn that piece of shit.
Okay. Yeah. Muggles, right? And that's going to do it for another episode of Scorncast. Thanks to Ghostface Mella for stopping by. Thanks to Bug for our theme music. And just a reminder, you can visit PopScorn at scornpop.blogspot.com, and you can email PopScorn at scornpop@gmail.com. And now, Accio Napmat.